I think most of you know that I'm a public school administrator, and I deal constantly with the threat of what we would call, or what we used to call, No Child Left Behind. And we don't refer to that anymore. Now just the Education Act. And quick overview of that legislation for you simply says that by the year 2014, every one of our students in a public school education, or in a public school is to reach proficiency. We are to have 100% of our students testing at proficient levels. And years ago, when this first came up, several administrations ago, you know, it was a, really quite a banner to get behind in education. And who would say, oh, there, you know, we can't do that, and we're going to do that, and we're going to reach that goal. But the reality is, as we get closer to that goal, we realize we can't reach that goal. And as the requirements go up on us each year, we struggle with it more and more as public school administrators and public school teachers. But we sit around, and we're not giving up. We're not giving up, but we sit around, we as administrators, and we go to conferences, and we visit with our colleagues, and we say, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to reach this goal and keep moving forward as much as we can? And in that conversation and in that thought process, as an elementary principal, I'm always thinking about, okay, how can I make my presentations to my staff, just more motivating and those kinds of things. And I came across some material that I thought would be really good, and it has been. My staff has received this very well, to inspire them about change. And it's called 212 Degrees. Has anybody ever came across this presentation? If you're interested in this, after I share about it a little bit, it's from a company called Simple Truths, simpletruths.com. They've got a lot of different lessons, if you will, or they're really more like devotionals, inspirational presentations. And it comes with a book and a little DVD in the back and just a beautiful presentation. And 212 degrees is all about, well, who can tell me what happens at 212 degrees to water? It boils. That's what this is all about. At 211 degrees, you have hot water. That's all you've got. And you can do a lot with hot water. But one more degree, and it makes steam. And you can do so much more with steam. Steam locomotives and all those kinds of things. So it's the idea that so often in our lives, just a little bit more, one more degree, one more whatever it might be. And so that's the message that I took to my staff as we started school almost 9 months ago now this last year. We're doing a great job. We're doing a good job. Things are coming along. But what is that little thing, that one more little thing that we can do in the spirit of 212 degrees, that one extra degree to take it from 211 and make it happen? And as I shared this material and went through this presentation, and I've done it a few years now, I thought, you know, there's just a lot of principles in this presentation that seemed awful familiar to me. And as I thought about it, I thought, you know, the idea in this book, in this presentation, really is biblical. But there's no scriptural references or anything like that in here. And so my lesson today comes from this presentation, but I've worked through it and found the biblical basis behind it. So that's what I want to share with us this morning. And it's really about keys to unlocking change. Keys to unlocking change in our lives. What is it that we can do to just ramp it up, if you will, that little bit that can make all the difference in the world? You know, we're constantly being asked to change, if you think about that. Constantly being asked to change. Consider your health. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Kathy and I had a wonderful evening out at Dave and Sandy's house. And I found out that I'm almost as old as Dave is. And when you get to our... When you get to our age, you know, you start having health problems and health issues. And I've gone to see my doctor more this last year than I have in my entire life. And there's nothing wrong with me, well, medically speaking, but it's just when you get to Dave's age, our age, you have to go see the doctor more. There's just things you start doing at our age just to stay on top of things. And he talks to you about, well, got to change that weight, got to change that diet, and, you know, lifestyle changes that, that are being thrown at us all the time. We're being asked to do more. We're being asked to do less. Technology. Think about how technology is just changing all the time. I can remember, I'm probably the last guy in the world that started using a computer mouse. I can remember protesting the computer mouse. Remember when that came out? Oh, it's been a while now. But I can just remember as things were changing and evolving with computers, I'm not going to use this mouse. And I took great pride, if you will, in keeping up on all the keystrokes and all the little function keys and all the different things to do, not to use that mouse. And then one day I just gave in because everybody else in the family was using the mouse, and I started using it. I thought, that was easy. What have I been fighting this thing for? You know, just things like that. And now the big fight for me is texting. I just refuse to do it. I just call me. Don't text me, just call me. And by the time I figure out how to type no, which is the response to my kids when they text me, I could have called them and told them twice by the time I finally figured out the technology. What about the skills that we are being asked to continue to develop and improve on in doing our jobs, our job performance? Every Sunday, Dan is up here, breaking the bread of life unto us. And how often is it about changing? You know, we got to pray more, we got to study more, we got to sin less, all of those things. And we're constantly being called to do these things, to change, to make these changes. As I said, already about health and growing older. Kathy and I, today we're just struggling. We're stiff and we're sore. And we're trying to figure out, well, what did we do? And the only thing we did yesterday, we went for a boat ride. And it just took it out of us. We can't explain it. And it took us 10 minutes to walk from the car through the parking lot. Just we were stiff. Constantly, changes are happening in our lives that we can't do anything about, and we're being asked to change all the time. And really, honestly, we need to change. Change is about growing up. It's about maturing. It's about learning. It's about improving. It's about getting better. It really is. And so why, if we are constantly being asked to change, and overall it's good for us most of the time, why is it that we so often struggle with it, or we fight it, or we just refuse to do it? Why is that? And I think there are a lot of answers to those questions or to that question. And today I hope to maybe speak to a few of them as I share with you some keys to unlocking change, with the idea that it is good for us. It is about maturing. It is about, I hope, in the context today, growing in the Lord. The first idea I'd like to share with you about to unlocking change in our lives, and this is maybe more about when you are maybe challenging somebody else in your family, or maybe somebody you work with, to consider change. This is certainly true when I come to my staff as an administrator and say, we need to be going in this direction. There's a couple of ways that I can try to manage that. I can say, I'm the boss and we're doing it. That really works well. Or I can present to them the change that's possible and why it's so positive. And that's the key there. We need to make sure, as we consider change, that our first exposure to that change is a great exposure, that it's a great experience, that it's a positive experience. So, for example, if I go to my staff and I talk about we're going to make these changes in the instruction of reading and talk to them about how it's going to benefit students and how it's going to benefit us and how it can help us achieve and reach the goals that we set ourselves and for our students in reading and paint that picture about how we can do it all, I'm going to get a lot more buy-in than coming to them and saying, as I said before, this is what we're doing starting on Tuesday. It's just not going to work as well that way. Consider, if you will, that's exactly what God did for us when He called us to change, and really I say us, called the world to change when He presented the church to us. Think about the first time that we were exposed to the church. It was in... It was just an amazing picture. If you go back into the book of Acts and look at the church when it was first presented to us, the power, the miracles, the ability to change lives right now in dramatic, wonderful, amazing ways. You know, it wasn't just this little idea over here that we want you to think about, but this is a life-changing event, and you need to get on board with Jesus Christ. And as people were hearing that and coming to an understanding about Jesus Christ, you know, Acts tells us how they were cut to the heart. And they realized the need to have this amazing thing or to be a part of this amazing thing, the church. The church. I mean, the whole purpose of miracles was to show and demonstrate the power and the authority behind Jesus Christ and the apostles and the church that they were bringing to us. But think about us sometimes. How do we present the church to others? Too many times, the presentation that I've made of the church to others has been to argue doctrine with them. You know, think about that. When we have that opportunity to present, if you will, the gospel, the church to somebody, how are they seeing it from us? First of all, are we living the life that ought to draw their attention to it as something that's positive? I was in a conversation the other day with some of my teachers and my janitor about some spiritual things, about some things from the Bible. And my janitor later on, Mike's his name, says, "Well, you weren't saying anything." Well, I wasn't. I was just kind of listening. But as I was listening to them, they were arguing. And I just realized I didn't want to get in the middle of the argument. Because I've been in those arguments so many times. And you know what? I don't think I've ever argued anybody into the church. Have you? I've done it plenty of times. I've tried it a bunch of times, especially when I was a younger man. But I honestly don't think I've ever argued anybody into the church. Because through my arguing, I don't think the church looks very good. Another key to change here, I think, is just to recognize the makeup of large groups. When you look at large groups, like this congregation or maybe where you work, the group of people, especially, you know, if you have a group of people that, you know, 10, 15 plus, I think you can say about any of those groups approximately that size that they're made up of three different types of people. And think about that here at Cedar Lou. I think you'll agree. First of all, you have your superstars. And 5 to 10% of most groups, you can identify the superstars in that group. And these are the people, they get it done. They make it happen. They are self-starters. They are self-motivated. You don't have to tell them what to do. They're already doing it and trying to get you to get on board with it. And I found that to be pretty true with any group that I've looked at of any size. And then you have the second group, which I like to refer to as the backbone people. And that's about 80% of your group, the backbone people.
Now, the big difference between your backbone people and your superstars is that the backbone people need external motivation. They'll get it done for you, but you've got to light a fire under them first. You've got to motivate them. You've got to inspire them. You've got to move them. But once you do, man, they get it done. They are there 100%. And that's most of us. We just need to realize that's most of us. And if you think about that, that really is, it really does fall in line, I think, with Scriptures. I mean, think about what are our church services all about if it's not about getting together and being motivated and being inspired to move. Excuse me, to move to action, to get it done. I mean, isn't that what you're doing every Sunday, Dan? Trying to move us. And you do a great job at that. But 80% of us need that on a regular basis. I mean, in Scriptures we refer to as what? Sheep. Sheep need to be led. Sheep need to be shepherded. Okay? That's 80% of us. And then there's another group here. And I use this word a little bit loosely. There are stronger words that I would have liked to have used but didn't think they were appropriate from the pulpit. But that other group is, we'll just refer to them as mediocre. That's about as kind as I can get. Mediocre. 5 to 10%. And unfortunately, this group tends to be negative, tends to resist change. Now, I think it's important to understand this, because it kind of leads up to another point here that I want to make, is that we need to stop giving power to negative people. Groups that give power to negative people don't get it done, don't change, and will often die out. And we all know of examples of that if you think about it, in the church, unfortunately, as well. But we've got to stop giving power to negative people. And we need to ask ourselves, who are God's superstars? Our church leaders need to be our superstars. And I think if we consider what the book of Ephesians says in chapter 4, we all have a work and a variety of work and a variety of purposes and a variety of jobs there. But the bottom line is we all need to be doing our work and building each other up so we are not blown hither and thither by every wild idea that comes around. That's kind of a loose translation there of Ephesians 4, but I think you get the idea. Too often we have defined the strength of a group by comparing it to a chain. Have you heard that before? A chain strength is defined by its what? Its weakest link. Of course you've heard that. And so often we use that analogy to describe the strength of a group as our strength is defined by our weakest members. Well, we gotta stop doing that. A group's strength needs to be defined by its superstars. And of course, the church's first and foremost superstar is Jesus Christ. And I am not going to limit the power of the church to its weakest members, but I'm going to tap into the power for the church in its greatest superstar. I think this congregation has done a wonderful job of putting superstars in place of leadership. Let me ask you this question too. Can you give me an example in the Bible where God gave power to negative people? Now you can find and give me plenty of examples where negative people have power, but did God give it to them? Now don't throw me that argument that, well, they couldn't have it unless God allowed it. I understand that. But that doesn't refute the point. Most of the time, those people are in those positions because they assumed the power. They ramrodded themselves into those positions, and we need to make sure that that's not happening if we're going to be moving forward and being the people that God has called us to be, being the people that God has prepared us to be. So where do we start? Real change, when we talk about it in a group, needs to come from our superstars. And I believe, again, I'll say this, as a congregation, I think we've done an amazing job of putting superstars in place of leadership here. But we need to think about this in the context of ourselves. The context of ourselves. Because I think, too, you can become a superstar if you don't see yourself there. I think you need to believe that you can be. Now, that doesn't... I've got to be careful when I say that, because we don't
We don't need everybody to be superstars. That 80% backbone is pretty important. I mean, those are the troops that get it done. And those numbers need to be strong. We just need to have those leaders that are moving us forward like we do here. But again, we need to think about this in the context of ourselves. We need to remember the thought that I just quickly referred to from this presentation, 212 degrees. And by the way, you can go online and see this. So if I've got you curious about this, simpletruth.com, and you can see this, or I'll lend it to you. Got it right here. The point is, what little thing can I do? I think sometimes we're overwhelmed by change because we think it has to be done in big, sweeping movements in our lives. And that's not necessarily true. Sometimes it's the little things. Sometimes we need to realize that we're just so close, but it's just that one more little thing that if I just did this or was more consistent here, it would make all the difference in the world for myself, for my family, and maybe even for this body of the Lord's people. Do not underestimate your ability to have an influence in this congregation, in this community, and in this world. God created you with that purpose. You have to believe it, though. And maybe that's the change. Maybe that's the one more degree you need to turn it up, is believing in what God created you for and then acting like it. See, it's easy to intellectualize it. It's easy to be logical about it and say the right thing. Believing is acting upon it, though. Behaviors versus beliefs is another part of this. Sometimes you just have to do it before you believe it. Let me give you a couple examples. I thought I'd remember this, and now I've forgotten it. Kathy, on your mirror is taped a little thing that says, complain and remain, praise and raise. Another one along that line is raise the praise, minimize the criticize. I was at a conference here a couple of weeks ago with some of my teachers, and one of the big education gurus was speaking in Iowa, so a bunch of us went over to hear him speak. And one of the things that he said, it's kind of amazing. I mean, this guy is a guy who's having an amazing, Doug Fisher is his name, he's having an amazing influence on education today. If you're a teacher, anything Doug Fisher writes, just go by and read. I mean, that's how good he is, okay? It's like us as Christians. Anything that the Apostle Paul writes, read it, right? Just automatic, okay? Doug Fisher's, when it comes to education, same kind of thing. And so he's in Iowa. Exciting. We go and we listen to him. And so he's this big, you know, PhD educated, written several books, speaks all over the world. He's at all the big conferences, excuse me, when it comes to education. And here's his advice. One of his pieces of advice. Says, I want your principles. Here's what you need to do to make the biggest, quickest change in your building as far as improving the climate in your building. Write 5 encouraging or thank you notes every day and give them to your staff. Just pick 5 people every day, write a little note, and give it to them. I thought, you got to have a PhD to figure that stuff out? I paid how much to come to this conference and hear that? You know, but yeah, I had to be reminded of that. Now, here's the thing is, you hear something like that, and it seems so simple, and some people might even say, oh, that won't make a difference. Well, I challenge you then, in your relationships, if you're in a position of as a supervisor, try it. If you don't believe it, try it. Do a little research. And if it doesn't work, fine. You didn't lose anything. But I think what we find out when we do things like that, sometimes that seems so simple, and we look at it and say, well, it's too simple, it'll never work, and we don't try it. Think about it in your marriage. You know, I went to school all the way down to Abilene, Texas, and sat in the classrooms of Faulkner and Brekeen to hear those kinds of things from them. You know, Kathy and I went to, when we were down that part of the country, went to any of their marriage enrichment workshops.
as often as we could. She kept saying I needed it. And I did. And it was those kinds of things that you would hear. And it's like, oh, that's just too simple. But again, try it. And when you try it and you see the difference it makes, it will make you a believer. And you won't stop doing it. Let me give you another example here. In Matthew chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, in that area, it talks about forgiveness. And it talks about that if we don't forgive, what happens? We won't be forgiven. In fact, it's a matter of salvation, isn't it? It's a matter of, I haven't had an opportunity to say this for a long time, so I'm kind of excited here. It's a matter of where your reservation is going to be, smoking or non-smoking. Give you a minute to think about that. When my parents divorced shortly after we were married, I hated my father. I hated my father. I could not forgive him, would not forgive him for the divorce of my parents, for the breakup of my family. And I acted upon that hate for a lot of years. I stopped having communication with my father. Father's days came and went. No cards from me. If we could be on the other side of the family for a holiday, that was my excuse. We were there. Whatever we could do to avoid that. My brother got married in 1984 and went to the wedding, and in the receiving line after the ceremony. My father was in that line at the end, and I'm supposed to be right next to him. Pretend the pulpit is my father. This is how far I stood from him at the end of that line. Do you think that stood out a little bit? I mean, that's what I was doing all the time while I'm preaching in my first church there in Candy Y, Minnesota. Boy, I was really, really behaving like it, wasn't I? But I hated him. And I blamed him for breaking up our family. And I can remember we're at the reception later on that night, and my little grandma, who's like 85 now, or 90. Ooh, duh. Isn't that funny? If I would have said she was 35 when she was 30, that would have been an insult. But now I say she's 85 when she's 90, and it's an insult. Somewhere in there it changes. But anyways, little grandma got in my face. She's not a member of the church, unfortunately. She said, "You better practice what you preach." And that kind of got my attention. But it was that passage there in Matthew 6. I'm reading that, and all of a sudden I realized my hatred of my father was going to send me to hell. Bottom line, I believe it. I believed it. I still believe it. And so I thought, what am I going to do about this? I prayed about it. And I went through all the right steps, and I said, I forgive you. I asked God to forgive me for my unforgiveness. I mean, I went through all of that. And I sat there and I thought, but I still feel miserable. I still feel hate. And I don't know where this came from. Yeah, I do. I know where this came from. I just realized I needed to start acting like it. So I started slow. Father's Day was coming up. Sent him a Father's Day card for the first time in a couple of years. Holidays coming up. Started, going back, getting together with the family, started talking to Dad again. I never went up to Dad and said, I forgive you. I didn't have to. We're from Minnesota, and it's kind of like Ole and Lena up there in Minnesota. Ole and Lena have been married a lot of years.
You know, and the punchline of the joke is, it's, you know, Lena says, "Ole, you never tell me you love me." And he says, "Lena, I told you on our wedding day I loved you, and if I ever change my mind, I'll let you know." Well, that's the way we are up in Minnesota, okay? I don't ever remember my dad until recently saying that he loved me, but I never questioned that. Because there were other ways that we communicated that. And there were other ways that I communicated to my father that I forgave him. And then all of a sudden, one day, I felt like it. I felt like it. And that's my point there, is sometimes we just, you know, some people will say, fake it till you make it. I don't like that. That's not what we're talking about here. But it's about acting like you know you're supposed to act. And when you do that, the feelings will catch up. They really will. I can attest to that. And now there isn't a time when my father and I are getting together or talking on the phone that the conversation doesn't end with the statement, "I love you, Dad." It never happens anymore. And it's kind of funny. I can hear Dad saying it back, and it's still kind of hard for him. It's that Minnesota thing, but he says it. Emotions and logic. Another issue here. The biggest inhibitor to change is often fear. Fear. Only emotions make change possible. Winning the argument, as I referred to before, the logic part of it, seldom touches the heart, the emotional part of it. Change, real change, has to be and will only happen when the heart is touched. Consider again, if you will, Acts 2:37. This magnificent new thing is laid out there, the church. And these people find out that they crucified the superstar of the church. And what's the text say? They were cut to the... It doesn't say they lost the argument. It doesn't say that. It says they were cut to the heart. And they couldn't change fast enough. What must we do? And as soon as they found out, boom. Boom, boom, boom. The splashes in the baptismal tank that day. Unending. Change, also something that also interesting about change is that if change is going to take place, it needs to be acted on quickly. In fact, I even have a little research for you here. The rule is that when you are moved to change, if you don't do it within 100 hours, about 4 days, you won't do it. And so when you are moved in your heart and you know you need to do it, do it. Nike says, just do it. And I think it's important to realize it's because of procrastination. When we procrastinate, motive and heart are often killed, and it doesn't happen. And we need to understand something else here, too. There are some other things in this spiritual realm fighting against us. And if you give them enough time, they will reclaim you. They will snatch it back from us. Satan wins when we put it off. When we know it needs to be done, when we know we need to change and we don't do it, you know, if you're moved at all today for any reason to repent, to take a step forward in the obedience of the gospel, if that's what you need to do, and you don't do it, you lose. And Satan wins as soon as you walk out that door. So why would you put it off? Change cannot happen too fast either. Consider, if you will, Matthew 7:21. Not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. If you know it is his will, and you want to spend an eternity, you must do it. You have to do it. Consider a couple of interesting points here. The average margin of victory between first and second place is often so small. It might only be 1 degree. Consider, if you will, The average margin of victory for the last 25 years, when you combine all the PGA, the Professional Golf Association major tournaments, the average margin of victory between first and second place has been 3 strokes. You know what that is? This right here. Boop. That's 1 stroke. 3 of those. That's been the difference between first and second place. The difference, though, between the money in first and second place, 76%. Huge. Huge. Finishing first or second in the church. Now, I don't even know if I should suggest something like that, but you just wrestle with that. During the 2004 Summer Olympic Games, the margin of victory in the men's 200-meter freestyle, 1.42 seconds. 1.42 seconds. In the women's, the same event, it was 0.59 seconds. Just a smidgen over a half a second, the difference between silver and gold. I mean, one more of these would have been a gold medal. I mean, that's how small the margin is here. In the 800-meter run, 800 meters, I can't hardly say it, let alone think about running that far. But the difference between gold and silver, 0.71 seconds. And in the women's, same event, 0.13 seconds. In the men's long jump, 28 centimeters. 20, it sounds like a lot, but a centimeter, that's a centimeter right there. 28 of those, side by side. The difference between silver and gold. In the women's event, the long jump, it was 11 centimeters. The average margin for victory for the past 10 years in both the Daytona 500 and the Indianapolis 500 has been 1.54 seconds. The difference there between first and second, over $600,000. If I'd just been 2 seconds faster, I would have won $600,000. More. The margin of error. How many times has your football team, you know, they come over and they measure for that first down and the referee goes, you know, didn't make it. Didn't get in the end zone. Season's over. What is it? What is that little bit? That little bit more that we can do that's going to make all the difference in the world. You know, thinking about change and the things that we need to do in life can cause a lot of stress. But I hope today I've been able to say something to make you think about the simple fact is maybe it isn't anything big I need to do, but it's just something little I need to do. And maybe that little thing you need to do today is to ask for prayers. Or to move forward on obeying the gospel. Or maybe there is somebody in your life that you've been harboring hate or unforgiveness or whatever it might be. And you need to address that in your life. Believe me, it'll make all the difference in the world. I want you to do something. Hold out your hand like this. This is audience participation. And pretend you're holding a glass of water. And just hold it there, okay? You're holding a glass of water. Now, how long do you think you can hold that glass of water there? A minute? 2 minutes? 5 minutes? I mean, some of you are already going, man, that arm is getting, you know, it's not just about holding that glass. But, I mean, really, and that kind of makes the point. We could probably all stand here and do this. Well, let's just do that. Let's just see how long we can... No. Probably could do that for a minute. You know, after 2 or 3 minutes, probably going like this, you know, it's going to start getting sore. It's already sore. I can see some of you are grit blue. You should see some of the slum of you are sweating already. Look at that. Put it down. Whew. The point is this. There's some things we probably all need to be addressing in our lives. And when we don't do it, when we're not willing to make those changes, that creates stress in our lives. And today I want to extend the invitation to you and give you the opportunity to put that stress down. You see, the problem here isn't the amount of the weight, you know, of that armor and that glass of water. It isn't that. It's the time. It's the time. And as you continue not to make those changes in your life, and you're holding on to something else, it might just be a little thing, but it's the amount of time you hold on to it. You know, what we're really talking about is, you know, sometimes it's sin we hold on to. And it might just be a little thing, but it's not the size of it, it's the amount of time we hold on to it that destroys us, that weakens us. I mean, if I did this long enough, I'd eventually collapse and Carl would have to run up here and do some kind of rescue procedure on me. And we do that with sin sometimes. And Jesus calls us today to lay our burdens down. And He reminds us to take upon us His yoke because His burden is light. If we can help you do that today, the invitation is extended to you. Won't you come while together we stand and sing?